Welcome to the Federal Society's podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's State Courts Project, was recorded on Monday, May 21st, 2018. Welcome to the Federal Society's Teleforum Conference Call. This afternoon, we'll be discussing the case for political appointment of judges, a new white paper by Professor Brian Fitzpatrick. This white paper is the second paper in a new series commissioned by the Society on the leading methods of state judicial selection. My name is Peter Bisbee, and I'm the Director of State Courts at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we're happy to have with us Professor Brian Fitzpatrick, who wrote the white paper and is also a professor of law at Vanderbilt University Law School. In addition, we're going to have Professor Steve Ware, professor of law at the University of Kansas School of Law. After remarks and discussion between Professor Fitzpatrick and Professor Ware, we'll go to question and answer from the audience. Thank you for speaking with us today, Professor Fitzpatrick and Professor Ware. The floor is now yours.
Thank you very much, Peter, for inviting me to talk to our members, and thank you very much to Professor Ware for joining me on this call. You know, the thesis of my remarks for today is that we ought to select judges by appointing them by elected officials. Elected officials ought to appoint our judges. And this is often referred to as political appointment of judges. As we all know, the federal government has been selecting its judges this way since the very beginning of our country. Federal judges are picked by the president, and his nominations are confirmed by the U.S. Senate. Those are all elected officials. That's political appointment. But our states do not use that method very often. Most states use a different method today for picking judges. A lot of states use elections, where judges run against other candidates for selection as a judge. Some states use partisan elections for their judges. This is much like an election for other offices, where each candidate's party affiliation appears on the ballot next to their name. Other states use nonpartisan elections to pick judges, where you have candidates run against each other, but there's no party affiliation on the ballot. Even more states use something that is called merit selection or the Missouri plan. That's the first state to adopt this method, or what I sometimes refer to as commission selection. This is where a small number of people on a committee or a commission recommends a small number of names, like three, to the governor, and then the governor gets to pick from that slate who will fill the open position on the bench. So all the power in the commission system lies, of course, with the commission, because they are the ones that are the gatekeepers to the governor. And the states that use this method, they pick their commissions in various different ways, but a common theme among all these states that use the commission method is that the state and local bar, so state and local attorneys, will have a lot of influence over the commission. Some states reserve spots for the bar. Some states the bar makes up a majority of the commission. So the bar lawyers have a lot of power in the commission system. So those are the different ways that we do things in this country: political appointment, partisan elections, nonpartisan elections, and the commission system. As I noted, the oldest of these systems is political appointment. That's what the federal government has done since the beginning of our country. It's also what all the states did at the beginning of our country. All of the states used some form of political appointment to pick their judges. Some states asked the governor to do it, some states asked the legislature to do it, and then some states, like the federal government, asked a combination of the executive and the legislature to do it. You know, at the time of the founding, there was not a lot of attention focused on why a political appointment was the best method. In the Federalist Papers, the proponents of the Constitution discussed this very quickly. They did not think it was possible to ask voters to pick judges because they thought voters would be overwhelmed by having to pick so many people because there are a lot of judges. And like the framers of the federal constitution felt about other high-level federal appointments, they thought the president was better suited to do the initial pick, and then the Senate was better suited to do the confirmation. So the framers of the federal constitution really saw judges as just like another high-level federal appointment, which was better vested in presidential nomination and legislative confirmation. The states changed fairly early on away from political appointment. First, the states switched to elections. Elections became very popular in the middle of the 1800s. First, partisan elections became popular, and then at the end of the 1800s, nonpartisan elections became popular. And then in the 1900s, many, many states switched to the commission system. It really grew out of the progressive era, the commission system. The notion was it was better to do government by experts as opposed to ordinary voters, and the experts on who would be the best judges would be the lawyers. And so the commission states vested a lot of power, as I noted, in the hands of lawyers. So we are in a situation today where the federal government and a few states use political appointment, but again, about half the states use a commission system and the other half are using some kind of election. The literature on which of these methods is best has been very theoretical, and what I'd like to do on this call is something a little different, and that is I'd like to try to use data to answer the question which of these four methods is the best method to select judges. And the way I'd like to use data to answer this question is I'd like to ask first, what do we want in our judges? What exactly are the characteristics and qualities that are important to us in judges? And then to ask, what does the data say about which system maximizes the qualities and characteristics that we want? So let me begin with the qualities and the characteristics. What exactly should we want in our judges? Well, you know, I'm not going to take a firm view about what we should want in our judges on this call. I'm just going to kind of rely upon what other commentators and observers have said are important characteristics. And not everyone agrees that all of these things I'm going to list are important, but I think that at least a lot of people think that each of these things is important. And so these are the criteria that I'm going to try to maximize as I further this discussion. So the first criteria that a lot of people talk about that they want in their judges is independence. They want judges to be independent of the public, of elected officials when judges are making decisions. A lot of people think it's a bad thing if judges acquiesce to pressure from the public or elected officials when they have a case in front of them. They want judges to have steely wills, to be able to resist external pressure to decide a case one way or another. I would say that this is especially important when the law is clear. If the law is clear that someone should win, the judges should not be twisting the law because they're afraid of getting in trouble with the public or an elected official. But a lot of times the law is not clear. And as I'm going to mention in a moment, it doesn't necessarily follow that we want judges to have steely wills and not care about what other people think when the law is not clear. So that's independence. Another criterion that a lot of people want in their judges is they want judges to be accountable when they make mistakes or engage in some kind of wrongdoing. The notion here is that if the judge's on-the-job performance is bad, then there ought to be some way to hold the judges accountable, to remove judges to discipline judges, et cetera, when they are not doing a good job. The third criterion is competence. This, I think, goes without saying. We want our judges to be smart. We want them to be lucid writers. We want them to have technical, legal expertise that is of the highest quality. The fourth criterion that is often mentioned is integrity. We want judges to be free from corruption. We don't want them to be open to bribery. We don't want them to be trying to use their office for other sorts of personal gain. That, I think, too, is pretty beyond debate. The fifth criterion is legitimacy. We want judicial decisions to be considered legitimate in the eyes of the public and policymakers. We want people to accept what judges decree in their decisions and not try to find some other way of resolving disputes. You know, it's often said that the judiciary is the least dangerous branch. They don't have the power of the military. They don't have the power of the purse like the executive and Congress do. And it's really just up to the goodwill of the judiciary to ensure that their decisions are followed. And so we want judges to be seen as legitimate by the public and policymakers so their decisions are followed without a lot of acrimony. Diversity. A lot of people believe that we want our judges to be diverse along demographic lines, racial lines, ethnic lines, gender lines. People want judges that look like the public. And the last criterion I might refer to as mainstream views or viewpoint representativeness. We want judges that are not going to make decisions that are way out of line with what we consider a mainstream decision in our various communities. And to refer back to something I mentioned before, this I think is very important when the law is not clear. If the law is ambiguous, then people can debate about how a case should be resolved, how a statute should be interpreted, how the Constitution should be interpreted. If it's debatable how things should be interpreted, perhaps then the public and policymakers should have their views vindicated in the interpretation of those laws. If the law is ambiguous, then there's no way to resolve a case based simply on legal materials. We often have to consult other things to resolve cases, like our policy preference or our world views. And in those situations, why shouldn't, in a democratic society, the public's views win out? And so having judges who reflect the mainstream in their communities, I think, is another criterion that a lot of people want in their judiciary. So those are the seven things that we want in our judges. And so then the question is, what is the data say about which of the four selection methods that I described earlier maximize these things? So I think we can make a few conclusions. First, the first two criteria that I mentioned, independence and accountability, these criteria really have nothing to do with selecting judges. These are things that really have to do with how we retain judges after they've been selected. So, for example, the people that wrote the federal constitution were very, very concerned with judicial independence. That was one of the most important things to them when it came to what kind of judges they wanted. And because of that, they wanted to give and did give judges life tenure. So life tenure maximizes the independence of a judge because the judge is free to have a steely will because the judge knows nothing can happen to the judge no matter what they do. Life tenure minimizes accountability. The public has very little way to discipline or remove a judge for misbehaving or making mistakes. In the federal system, all we can do is impeach a judge, and that's very hard to do. But, you know, where you want to draw the line on independence and accountability, whether you want life tenure, whether you want to make judges stand for re-election or for a reappointment after a certain number of years, whether you want it to be every 4 years or 6 years or every 20 years, we can debate all those things, but those things really have to do with retention method and not selection method. Those things are very unconnected in my view. And so I don't think we need to worry about independence and accountability very much when we talk about which method of selection is best. That's a debate we can have on a different call about what method of retention is best. The second conclusion I think we can make is that there's no evidence that one system produces more competent judges than another. Political scientists, legal scholars have tried to make this examination in many different ways. They've looked at how many years of experience judges have in each of the systems. They've looked at what quality of law schools judges graduated from. They look to how many opinions the judges are writing, how productive they are, how often their opinions are cited by courts in other states that don't have to cite their opinions but choose to cite them because they think they're so interesting and well-reasoned. So the scholars have looked at competence in every way we know how, and there's really no evidence that one system produces better judges than another. This surprises a lot of people. It surprises me. A lot of us suspected that elected judges might be less competent than other kinds of judges for various reasons, because the people who want to run for election are different than the people who don't want to run for election. You've got to raise money and shake a lot of hands and things like that. But the evidence does not support that. It seems like competence is a wash. So independence and accountability are irrelevant, and competence seems to be a wash between the systems. The same thing can be said about diversity. There's been a bunch of studies on diversity, and the studies all suggest that there's not a whole lot of difference between the systems. Or even if the studies don't suggest there's not a difference between the systems, the studies are inconsistent with what they find. So some studies say elections are better, some studies say other systems are better. There's, again, no firm way to conclude on the data that one system is better than another. So independence, accountability, irrelevant, competence, diversity, it seems to be a wash. All the systems come out about the same. What about integrity? I would say that the data suggests that integrity, the integrity factor, is a small negative to the elected systems, the partisan elections and the nonpartisan elections. Fare a little bit worse than the political appointment and the commission systems do. There's a small amount of data, a few studies, that suggest that judges that are elected are disciplined more often for misconduct, like financial improprieties or things like that, than the judges that come to the bench through other means. There's not a ton of data yet to support this conclusion, but there's a little bit, and so I'm willing to say that elections get a small negative on the integrity factor. What about legitimacy? On this factor, elections get a much bigger negative. There's a number of studies that ask people, do you think a judicial decision is legitimate if the judge has received campaign contributions from one of the litigants or one of the litigants' lawyers? And the surveys all suggest that the public does not see judicial decisions as legitimate if the judges are getting campaign contributions from those who are interested in the decisions. And the surveys even say that about judges making decisions in cases where they did not get campaign contributions from anyone, but an interested party nonetheless campaigned for or against the judge. If an interested party ran commercials on their own that said, elect this judge, and then the judge later had a case that affected that party, even though the judge didn't get a campaign contribution directly, the public still sees the decision as less legitimate. And it's just very hard to see how to run elections, whether partisan or nonpartisan, without campaign contributions or at least the right for people to engage in independent expenditures on behalf of or against candidates. And so legitimacy is an area where elections really fares worse than political appointment or the commission system. So we have two negatives for the elected systems, and that leaves us with one criteria left, and that is whether the judges have mainstream views. And you know, we've gotten this far, and elections are a little bit worse, it seems, than political appointment and the commission system. And the commission system and political appointment are kind of tied at this point as we go down our list. But I think the tie is really broken when it comes to how representative the views of the judges are of the two systems. There's a lot of emerging data. A study that I've done and a study that a political scientist at Stanford and a political scientist at Harvard have done that suggests that judges in the commission system are much less representative in their policy views than judges in the appointed system, the political appointment system. And the reason for this, the hypothesis for why the judges are less representative, is because attorneys tend to be much more liberal than the rest of the population. And if you put a bunch of attorneys on your commissions in the commission states, then it stands to reason that the attorneys on the commissions will want to find judges that agree with them about the important issues of the day. And if you have people who are more liberal than the public picking judges like the commissions, then the judges are going to end up far to the left of the public. And that's what the data suggests. My study and the study by the Stanford and Harvard political scientists all show that judges from the commission states are much more liberal than the people in those states. And that is not true for political appointment. Judges that are appointed by the elected governors or the elected legislatures of their states tend to have views that are very similar to the public's in their states, which would make sense because the public's elected the governor and the legislatures, and the judges picked by their elected officials tend to reflect their views. And so if you care about your judges having views that are representative of the public, then it looks like the political appointment method is better than the commission method, and that the political appointment method is better than the elected method on other criteria. So that has led me to the conclusion that political appointment is the best way to select judges. As I noted at the outset, there's actually two ways to do political appointment, and both ways are used by our states. So some states rely on the executive, like the federal government does, to pick judges with perhaps legislative confirmation. So states like California and New Jersey do that. But other states use the legislature to do it alone. The governor does not get involved. South Carolina and Virginia pick their judges that way. And I think there's so few data points of each method in use in our states today, it's hard to say whether one way of doing political appointment or the other is better. But I just note that there are two different ways of doing it, and it's not clear to me that one way would be superior to the other. So I think if you're interested in political appointment, you have some options on how you might do it. And in my own experience with this topic, I've noticed as I go around to various states and speak to people there that there does seem to be some growing interest in political appointment. Some states are reexamining their commission systems, and those states tend to be looking at a political appointment as the best alternative. In my home state of Tennessee, we abolished a mandatory commission system and let the governor nominate people with confirmation by the legislature. Kansas did the same thing for some of their judges, and I know a lot of other states like Oklahoma are considering the same thing. So My hope is that more and more states will return to the original method for selecting judges. You know, sometimes the best solution to a problem is the solution that's been staring us in the face all along, and I think political appointment of judges is one of those examples. But that's all I have, Steve. I'd love to hear from you on this.
Thank you, Professor Fitzpatrick, for an excellent summary just now on the phone and in your short paper of the history and the lay of the land of how the 50 states select their judges. Just for the audience, Professor Fitzpatrick is, in my opinion, doing work, research and writing, scholarly work on judicial selection, surpassed by no law professor in the country. Just really top-notch work, including the fact that he has a thesis, he has something to say, but he's always open to lawyerly argument and scholarly research to go where the evidence takes him. So really admirable work there from Professor Fitzpatrick. And he makes at least two big points that I agree with strongly. One is that the framers got it right on judicial selection, that when you look at state judicial selection, having governors and legislatures pick the judges is a better system than the alternatives of electing judges or having a nominating commission with special powers for the bar. And then the other big point Professor Fitzpatrick makes that I agree with strongly is that the initial selection of a judge, how a judge first gets on a court, ought to be distinguished from judicial retention. What keeps that judge on the court or removes the judge from the court? And that two very important topics, judicial independence and judicial accountability, much more relate to judicial retention. How a judge is retained really determines judicial independence and judicial accountability much more than those important things are determined by the initial selection of a judge. And then relatedly, Professor Fitzpatrick says about judicial retention and the trade-off between judicial independence and judicial accountability that reasonable people can disagree about where to strike the balance between those values. I agree with him fully on that. He and I would strike the balance slightly differently in that neither of us would go so far as life tenure. Both of us favor favor long terms for judges. And where Professor Fitzpatrick and I disagree is that he would have those long terms be renewable, whereas I would have the long term of a judge be non-renewable. So a judge after one term is done, just not as long as life tenure would as the length of the term. But now shifting to the focus of Professor Petrick's remarks and his paper, which is the initial selection of judges at the state level. Again, I agree with him fully that governors and legislatures, rather than voters or the bar, ought to be selecting. And therefore, my questions to Professor Fitzpatrick tend to be, I'll say, narrower questions from an ally, from somebody who looks at this topic similarly, generally, to him. And the first question for you, Brian, is to push maybe more strongly the negatives of the commission system. And then maybe second question, we'll try to rehabilitate the commission system a little bit. So the first question to push more the negatives of a commission system is really a rhetorical point. Your paper is called The Case for Political Appointment of Judges. And don't you agree that judicial nominating commissions are themselves very political, even if they purport to focus on the merit, professional merit, of judicial candidates, that it's inevitable. Politics will play a role in the commission's deliberation, and the politics might be not just progressive, conservative, Democrat, Republican kind of politics, but might be the politics of the bar, politics within the bar, different factions within the bar, or different personalities with influence over different members of the bar, and that it's a particularly pernicious sort of politics that goes on sometimes within judicial nominating commissions because it's behind closed doors, where most judicial nominating commissions take their votes on who are their finalists that they'll present to the governor in secret, with no sunshine, no accountability, as opposed to the sort of voting we see when a Senate votes to confirm a judge, and that's a publicly recorded vote.
I totally agree with you that these commissions are generally secretive, and it's hard to know, because they are secretive, what exactly goes on behind closed doors. But there have been a few studies over the years where political scientists have managed to break down the door through one means or another, and the conclusions that all of the political scientists that have studied it have come to is, of course, these commissions are political. Every group of humans is political in some sense. The commissions selecting judges are no different. So we should not be surprised to learn that members of the bar want to find judges that are going to make decisions that are both consistent with their policy views, but also good for their practices. These lawyers, their livelihoods depend upon what kind of decisions the judges make. If you're a plaintiff's lawyer, you need judges that are going to be pro-litigation, so you can file more cases, win more cases, get bigger attorney's fees. And lawyers that come from those practices, when they go on the commissions, they'd have to be superhuman to resist the temptation to put judges that are going to make decisions favorable to them on the bench. And the knowledge that these various lawyer constituencies will try to find judges that will reach decisions that are favorable to their practices can lead the commission states to go through incredible measures to try to balance out all the lawyer factions. And so in my state of Tennessee, before we got rid of our commission system, our commission was made up of, I think, 17 people, and 12 spots were reserved for the bar. And the state further subdivided those spots so that each faction of the bar would have an equal number of people on the commission. So there were three spots reserved for the plaintiff's lawyers, and those would be balanced out by three spots reserved for the corporate defense bar, and there'd be three spots reserved for the prosecutors, and those would be balanced out by the three spots reserved for the criminal defense lawyers. And so we really tried very hard to balance all the factions out, but there are more factions than there are spots on these commissions, and so it's an impossible job. But the fact that my state thought they had to do that is consistent with your notion, Professor Ware, that of course these commissions are going to be political when they do their work.
Well, thank you. And that point leads me to, just as a matter of word choice or salesmanship, that what we are advocating here, I think of as democratic appointment as opposed to political appointment, on the grounds that that alternative system is political too. And that negative I'm emphasizing here of the commission system, now I want to offset it with a push in the other direction of trying to rehabilitate commission system by taking the first point, which is democratic is really what I think we're seeking in judicial appointment system, as opposed to advocates of a Missouri plan kind of commission where the bar plays a significant role. And as you pointed out, different commissions in different states are appointed differently, that some states allow the bar to select some members of the commission, but in other states, members of a nominating commission are democratically appointed, selected. And my question to you is, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with having a three-step process where you have a democratically appointed commission that recommends three finalists to the governor, who then picks one, and then that person stands before the Senate or the full legislature or similar democratic body for confirmation?
You know, that's a great question, and I think it's actually a hard question to answer. You know, a lot of states where commissions are used are states where the commissions exist solely by the grace of the governor. So I'll tell you, in Tennessee, when we got rid of our Missouri plan and we went to gubernatorial nomination and legislative confirmation, the governor decided that he wanted to create a commission to send him names. And so he appointed all the members of his commission to send him names. So that is a democratically selected commission. When I did my research to look at how the views of the judges differ in the different selection methods, I did separate out the commission states where the commissions existed only by grace of the governor, and I didn't see that it changed the results. That, in other words, the judges in the democratically selected commission states are just as liberal as the judges in the states where the commissions are required by law, and the governor can't abolish the commission, and the governor doesn't necessarily pick all the members of the commission. And so I was surprised, frankly, that the democratically selected commissions did not do a better job of reflecting the views of the public when they pick judges. Now, why exactly the commissions don't do a better job when the governor is picking all the members as opposed to outsourcing it to the bar is a difficult question. And I'd frankly love to hear if you have any hypotheses in that regard, Professor Ware.
Well, I guess that's where I take the view more of let the chips fall where they may, in the sense that if the process is democratically legitimate, then the output I'm willing to accept. And I do see an argument that governors ought to stand behind their nominees without reservation. In other words, I recall a story from my neighboring state of Missouri where a governor was told the three finalists and sort of publicly let on that governor wasn't too happy with any of the three. And that sort of shifting the blame or passing the buck, you might say, Harry Truman from Missouri, right, would say the buck stops here, and that there's an advantage to not having a commission so that the governor has to be fully responsible for who the governor nominates, maybe as just a sort of realistic recognition that voters can only be expected to pay so much attention to an issue like this, and to the extent they want to hold a governor responsible for his or her nominees, that's about as much as you can expect. And digging into the details of who appoints how many members of a judicial nominating commission that only meets occasionally, just sort of more Byzantine and buried than is appropriate in an open democratic society.
I think that's a great point, and I think it might also be a point that counsels in favor of selection by a governor as opposed to selection by the legislature. You know, when you have so many different legislators that are responsible for picking judges, it might be hard for the public to hold them accountable than if you just have one governor that's responsible. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with that. I, again, think the framers got it right, and that having the executive branch nominate and the legislative branch confirm is a better system than having the legislative branch do it all. And I could talk further. I could ask you more questions, but if there's other people who want to jump in, I would welcome that.
And with that, let's go to some audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then pound. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer the questions in order we have received. And so while we're waiting for questions, I'm going to just flag to everyone that they should also check out the first edition in this judicial selection series, which was the Case for Partisan Judicial Elections, written by Professor Chris Bono at the University of Pittsburgh. And that can be found on our website, www.fedsoc.org. All right, so it looks like we have our first question. And go ahead with your question whenever you're ready.
This is John Vecchione of Cause of Action. The Missouri plan, I think, as you pointed out, tends to make judges that are to the left of the population of those states. And I would wondered if you could explain a little more how that occurs and why that is.
Sure. So there's basically two hypotheses on this. And the hypothesis that I mentioned earlier is the one that I initially was attracted to when I started this research. But I have to tell you, the second hypothesis may actually be the better one. So the first hypothesis is, in the commission states, the bar has more of a role in selecting judges than in the states that use elections or the states that use appointment by elected officials. And that's because, as Professor Ware and I noted, a lot of these commission states reserve spots for the bar. Like in Tennessee, again, before we got rid of it, 12 out of 17 spots were selected by four bar associations. So you give a lot of power to the lawyers. The lawyers are left of the public. There's a terrific study, again, by these political scientists at Harvard and Stanford, Bonica and Sen, S-E-N. They've done some terrific papers that take the Martindale-Hubbell Directory of Lawyers, and they run it through the databases on campaign contributions. And they create a picture of how liberal the legal profession is. And the picture is that the average lawyer is basically Bill Clinton. And so the average lawyer is more liberal than the average American. So if you put people in the selection apparatus who are more liberal than the rest of us, the hypothesis is they will pick judges that align with their views, not our views, and that leads them to pick judges that are more liberal than the rest of us as well. Now, the second hypothesis is that the people on these commissions are not selecting at all based on ideology of the judges. They're not doing that. They're just looking for technical expertise or what have you. They're not looking at all at ideology. And nonetheless, even if that's true, the commission system would still lead to more liberal judges because, again, the lawyer population is more liberal than the general population. And if you don't screen for ideology and you have a population that is left of the public and you don't screen it for ideology, if you randomly pick people, in other words, from that population, you're going to end up with judges that are more liberal than the population as well. So if you take an attorney population that's more liberal, you don't screen for ideology, you're going to end up with judges that are more liberal. So the second hypothesis is partisan elections and political appointment do screen for ideology from the lawyer population, and that's why they do a better job of reflecting public views than the commission systems or nonpartisan elections. The reason why the second hypothesis may have more validity than the first hypothesis is that as we've done these studies, my study and Bonica and Sin did their study as well, the studies show that nonpartisan elections have the same leftward bias in the judiciary. They produce the same leftward bias in the judiciary that the commission systems do. So the commission systems are not worse than nonpartisan elections. And so, you know, nonpartisan elections do not give outsized influence to lawyers. Nonpartisan elections are a system where it's just hard to screen for ideology. And so if the bias to the left is the same in the nonpartisan election states as it is in the commission states, it suggests that the problem is not the outsized influence of the bar, but the problem is the inability to screen for ideology among a left-leaning lawyer population to start with.
All right. And again, to ask a question, please enter star, then pound on your telephone keypad. All right, go ahead with your question.
Yes, my name is Steve Herb. I'm in Columbus, Ohio, and I founded and run a courtroom monitoring advocacy effort. So this is a subject obviously near and dear to my heart. First off, I have an observation. The framers got it right. One of you two mentioned that the framers got it right on judicial appointment. However, I think it's obvious by the level of interest in any president getting an opportunity to appoint a U.S. Supreme Court judge that there is a great concern over having a judge on the bench for life. That's my observation on that subject. As far as the can't screen for ideology and the entire system, I for one believe firmly in the power of the vote, and I would propose that we tweak the elected system rather than any of the other systems that you've gone over that we currently have around the country. I would tweak the elected system by removing the candidate's need to raise money by setting up a means of the government for government funding of all candidates who have qualified for the ballot. So therefore, each qualified candidate would receive an equal amount of funding, period. No other donations would be allowed. Here in Ohio, for instance, our judicial candidates are muzzled regarding specific positions. They're muzzled specifically by the canons of ethics issued by the Ohio Supreme Court. They are not allowed. I know this firsthand because I acted as a campaign chairman for a judicial candidate, and I had to go through the training that the judicial candidates have to go through. I didn't receive any continuing ed credits for it, but they did. And they're not, yes, during the campaign, they're allowed to campaign on one party or another party and advertise that they're Republican or they're Democrat. But you're right, when it comes time here in Ohio for the actual ballot, the voters are not able to see which party that candidate was funded by, which party that candidate was running on the ticket of. So I don't understand the logic in that. They're trying to make it seem clean, but it's not transparent. So bottom line is the judges are muzzled regarding specific positions. They're not allowed to come out and say, well, I in such and such a type of a case, like for instance a custody case, I would rule on the side of this or on the side of that. They are muzzled when they're campaigning about how they stand on any issues. So therefore, it makes it impossible, in my opinion, to screen for ideology. So that's it, and I'm really enjoying this topic. Thank you, fellas, for conducting this.
Peter, I'm gonna chime in for a minute with a response, and of course, Professor Ware should do so as well if he'd like. But I couldn't agree with you more that we could have better judicial elections than we do. I had the great honor of being a law clerk to Justice Scalia after law school, and when I was clerking for him, the Supreme Court decided a case called Republican Party of Minnesota v. White, where Justice Scalia and four of his colleagues held that the First Amendment protects the rights of candidates for judicial office to tell people their views of the important legal issues of the day. So I am sorry to hear that in some parts of this country, judicial candidates still feel like they are muzzled by the bar in sharing their views with the voters. I totally agree with you. There's no point in having an election if you're not allowed to tell people what you would do if you got the job. Now, the question is, even if we were to make our judicial elections better in the way that I think Justice Scalia envisioned that his opinion would do, would they be better than political appointment? And I just return again to this problem with the campaign contributions. Now, you say, let's make the campaigns run on public money. And I think that that is possible to do. But you still can't get rid of, again, consistent with the First Amendment, the independent expenditures. If you have the coal company executive spending $1 million to elect a judge, the judge never gets a campaign contribution from the coal company executive, but the executive runs commercials on TV. When the judge has to sit in a case that affects the coal company executive's business, the public tells us that they don't trust that decision. And I just don't know how you get around the independent expenditure situation in an election. Even if you have public funding of elections, you can't stop people from spending their own money on the race. And so I think it's an intractable problem that elections face. And I think the way to avoid the problem is to just let elected officials do this selection.
This is Stephen Ware agreeing again with Professor Fitzpatrick. First in some speech that muzzling judicial candidates or citizens who want to make independent expenditures seems to me a bad idea and inconsistent with the First Amendment. But the Ohio example of elections where really Ohio and Michigan are in sort of two gray areas between partisan elections and nonpartisan elections. And it seems to me an example of how attempts to depoliticize judicial selection tend not so much to reduce or eliminate politics, but just to hide it from the public and make the system less transparent. And so I really do think we all ought to accept that, particularly at the state Supreme Court level, where judges are dealing not only, as Professor Fitzpatrick's paper says, with ambiguities in the law, whether that be constitutional or statutory law, but also making the common law, right? State Supreme Court, very traditional for centuries as the final word on state's common law, that the policymaking side of judges ought to be acknowledged frankly, and that the necessary democratic politics of that ought to be out in the open where voters can see governors nominating and Senate confirmation hearings questioning the nominee about those sorts of issues.
All right. Well, with that, we are just about done with our hour, so I'm going to go ahead and wrap things up. This was a fantastic call. And on behalf of everyone at the Federalist Society, I'd like to thank Professor Fitzpatrick and Professor Ware for their valuable time and expertise today. I'm also going to mention that if you'd like to see a complete landscape of state judicial selection across the country, visit statecourtsguide.com, where you can click on every state and see just exactly how their judges are selected. For listener feedback, feel free to shoot us an email at info@fedsoc.org. We thank you all for joining us today, and this call is now adjourned. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. For materials related to this podcast and for other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit us at the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.